tell you, this Ohio humor.
I got it started.
Okay. Okay, great.
Tell them what you're talking about.
Welcome, everyone, and good afternoon. Hope you had a good lunch. You're all fed up, hopefully not too tired. I'm going to be speaking about something you probably all have heard before. It's always good to do review, I find, at least for myself. Review's always a good thing, and I sometimes pick up something new even in my review of things that I've already spoken on. So today we're going to talk about a little something called the Mark of the Beast. And I'm sure we all have ideas of what that is or how that works out. But I'm going to take it back to the Torah and the Scriptures, and we're just going to see what it has to tell us about it. Now, I think we need to tackle a couple of things first as far as really understanding, like Scott was touching on it earlier, how the Scriptures are laid out, right? And how it's a good way to understand and to read them and to study them. And like he was saying, the way things are strung together, all the different scriptures that work one with another, the way they all are connected. And this is what I find so fascinating with the sages and the rabbis. They make connections in things that I never even considered before. But they have the advantage because they understand the culture, they understand the language, they understand a lot of things that I was never raised with or brought up with. And it's foreign to me at this point as I'm trying to learn it. So they pull out some concepts and some ideas, and you're just blown away by the connections they make. But one of the main things I learned early on was that the end is declared out of the beginning, which is Isaiah 46:10. Actually, in the book of Isaiah, the prophet mentions something along that lines seven times in his writing, that the end is declared from the beginning. Ecclesiastes mentions it too, and I'm going to go there in a second, just to make sure we've got that concept in our minds. This is why when I have somebody coming to me with something out of Revelation, they jump to the end of the book, and they want to explain something or go somewhere, I'll say, well, that sounds lovely, but can you show it to me in the first five books? Because if it's not in the foundation, then it's a good possibility it doesn't even really exist. It's just some theology we've developed or made up or strung together in an incorrect way. So if you go to Ecclesiastes chapter 1, yeah, I'll go back to that one in a minute.
Well, everybody's there now.
Oh. Well, I'm going to make them jump around a little bit then. Oops, I keep passing it here. All right, Ecclesiastes 1. And I'm going to start in verse 9. That which has been is that is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there anything of which it is maybe said, see, this is new. It has already been in ancient times before us. And it's interesting because if you even talk to secular people about history, if we don't study history, what are we destined to do?
Repeat it.
I find it fascinating that in my Christian walk, no one ever taught the roots in the history of Christianity. If I would have learned that at that time, I might have had a different outlook and some different questions. But later on, obviously, I figured that out and started looking at the history of it all, where this began, because it's not really that new. Also want to go to Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and we're going to start in 14. Everybody there? I know that whatever God does, it shall be forever. Nothing can be added to it and nothing taken from it. God does it that men should fear before him. That which was already being and what is to be, has already been, and God requires an account of what is past. And I know in the Bread Out of Shot, it mentions a couple of things as well, that Yeshua handles the sins that are past. In Romans chapter 3, 25, and 2 Peter 1, 9, which is really kind of interesting because that makes us responsible for the things of the future. Our own responsibility. He handles our past issues, but now we need to, now that we've come into this, be responsible for our future things. And that's, again, I'll give you those two again. Romans 3, 25 and 2 Peter 1, 9. Now we're going to hop over to the last one I'll touch on, and that's Isaiah 46, 10.
What was the one before Romans 3, 25?
1 Peter 2, is that the one?
No, before Romans 3.
Ecclesiastes 3.
1, 9 and 3, 15.
Thank you.
3:15.
Isaiah 46:10, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times things that are not yet done, saying, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure. And it's really critical to understand a little bit about the Father. This is how we can prove that he's faithful. His word always comes to pass. This is why he can't change. It says in many places that he does not change. If he did change, we lost that faithfulness part. What he says, he has to bring to pass. And again, these are concepts, once we really get them, I guess, cemented into our minds and our hearts, as we're reading scriptures, it really helps us to understand, kind of like Scott was laying up today. A lot of things that we understand the background and some of the idioms, it's going to help us to understand what we're reading, how we should be interpreting it, and whatnot. So I think I'm going to begin, again, I had notes on this, but they seem to have gone missing. So,
dog ate them.
Yeah, the dog ate them. So we're going to wing this, which, you know what, I actually don't mind doing that half the time. Again, this is something I've done many times. So here we go. We're going to begin with Revelation 13, which I hate doing, starting out at the end and working our way back, but hopefully it'll make a point. Revelation chapter 13. Yeah, I think I'm going to start in verse 11. Everybody there? Then I saw another beast coming up out of the earth, and he had two horns like a lamb, and spoke like a dragon, and he exercised all the authority of the first beast in his presence, and caused the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. He performs great signs, so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he has granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast, who was wounded by the sword and lived. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, and the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their hand or on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark, or the name of the beast, or the number of his name. Here is wisdom. Let him who has understanding calculate the number of the beast, for it is the number of man, and the number is 666. Now, I don't know if anybody's ever seen Rico's take on this 666 idea. I don't really want to get into that today because that's a whole other teaching in itself. I basically want to talk about what this mark idea is representing and what it's all about. Because I know there's a lot of people, and I was one of those back in the day where, man, just the talk of this would freak you out. Oh my goodness, the mark of the beast. What is it? Is it a computer chip? Is it a number stamped on your forehead? Is it a social insurance number? Is it a new chip that just came out in our cards? I actually got rid of a bank card because of that at one point. Because it was a little freaky, right? Because all these new technologies coming in. Now my question would be, since when does God use a technology or need a technology to deal with man? He doesn't. Really, it's not an issue. So when I started settling down and doing some researching and realizing, okay, let's find out a few things. Again, if the end is declared out of the beginning, this is obviously the end or pretty close to the end. So let's see if we can find this back at the beginning. So this whole idea of a sign or a mark. Now that is the Hebrew word, and I'll go back here to my notes. Sorry, I gotta scooch around. Be patient with me. Whole idea of this is this word is in the Greek, it's simeon. And it means a sign of something past. That's kind of interesting. A memorial, a monument, a token, or a mark. A sign by which the divine power is made known. And that's in the Greek, which really kind of helps the understanding a little bit. Now, if we take it to the Hebrew, because you really have to realize this was all written in Hebrew. Because they're Hebrews, they're speaking to, right? It gets translated in other languages, but basically we need to look at the Hebrew. So in the Hebrew, it's the word oath, which is number 226 in the Strong's. And it means a signal, a flag, a beacon, a monument, an omen, prodigy, evidence, miracle, token, or a mark.
Sign.
There's that mark or sign again. So, being the studious student that I was, I decided, let's go back and find this mark idea somewhere else in the Torah. Anybody have any idea where we find a mark or a sign in the Torah?
Okay.
Yeah, that's a good one. We're going to get to that one.
Mark of the Sabbath.
Exactly. Do you know where that one is, Bonnie?
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Deuteronomy?
It is. It's in Deuteronomy, but I'm going to go to Exodus 31 for that one, okay? We'll kind of take a little walk through the Torah on some of this stuff. Exodus 31.
It's also in Genesis, but
yeah, it's actually all over the place. It's in Leviticus 19:3. It's in Leviticus 26:2. Let me see here. Well, I'll read this one because this is a really good one.
Exodus what?
Exodus 31, verse 12. And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbaths, it's plural, you shall keep. For it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you. You shall keep the Sabbath, therefore, for it is holy to you. Everyone who profanes it shall surely be put to death. For whoever does any work on it, that person shall be cut off from among his people. Work shall be done for 6 days, but the seventh is the Sabbath of rest, holy to the Lord. Whoever does any work on the Sabbath day, he shall surely be put to death. Therefore, the children of Israel shall keep the Sabbath, to observe the Sabbath as throughout their generations as a perpetual covenant. It shall be a sign between me and the children of Israel forever. And that's the Hebrew word again, H226, and it's oat. Same idea we're talking about with the mark of the beast in Revelation. So we're making a connection here. Now,
how do you spell that word you're saying?
O-W-T-H.
But the interesting thing is in the Hebrew, it's an aleph vav tav. So you got the aleph, beginning, the tav, the ending, and the vav is the connecting or the nail. So it's an interesting word all the way around.
It certainly is.
Yeah, vav by itself usually means hand.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. Now this sign is also stated in Deuteronomy 31, 12 to 18. And it's a perpetual covenant, by the way. And I'll give you a bunch of verses where it mentions this. Exodus 13, 9 to 16. Numbers 16, 28. Deuteronomy 6, 8. Deuteronomy 11, 18. Deuteronomy 28, 46. I'll slow down. Sorry. I tend to get going a little quick here.
Do you have the Ezekiel one?
I do. I've got some from Ezekiel as well. Ezekiel 20, 12. Ezekiel 20, 20. And Ezekiel 44, 5. So we've got a few witnesses there that mention that his Sabbaths and his covenant are a sign on us. So I guess the big question is, how do we know we have the sign of the Sabbath on us?
Because we keep it.
Exactly. What? We keep it. Oh. Right?
Bear witness.
It's basically we're bearing witness. And again, in the first time, let me think now. It mentions in Deuteronomy 5, it says, remember the Sabbath. And it's interesting because to me, it's Yah pointing out, we're going to forget. I'm sorry? Oh, that's Exodus 20. I'm sorry. That's the first time it's mentioned. And it's interesting because the Sabbath is first brought up where? Genesis. Right at the very beginning. Before anything, he sets that day aside. And he sets that day aside as a sign that he is the king, he's the creator. And so when we honor his sanctified day, we're actually being a testament and a witness to him as the creator. So we rest like it says he did. We're being that same witness. So the whole idea of having that sign, and it mentions the sign is a mark where?
On your head?
And on your forehead, which is an idiom. I'm sorry, head and hand. Which is actually an idiom for on the head is you're studying it, you're learning it, and on the hand, you're actually doing something on it, right? So we're practicing something that is visually seen by other people. Okay? How many witnesses does God require?
Two or three.
Two minimum, right? Now, if we think back to what we read in Revelation, where is that mark of the beast?
Hand or
head. It's one. Right? So the enemy doesn't care if he's only got one witness. Doesn't matter to him. This is how we can tell something is of God. You got to have minimum two witnesses. And I was bad for this. Beginning off, you pray to God for a witness, you get one, you run with it. Rather than waiting and checking, where's the second witness? We need to have the second witness before we move on these things. Otherwise, it's pretty easy to get deceived. Oh, that's a good point, too. The whole issue of clean and unclean. Let's look at the animals, for instance. What are the two signs? Two. By the way, two witnesses that an animal is clean.
Love and hoof, and he chews the cud.
Chews the cud, gotta have both.
We have some cloven hooves running around.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's why these are dangerous ones. That's why pigs are dangerous.
But,
well, nothing we do, but we don't own the place.
Okay, but you know about...
Well, I know. It's, what are you going to do, right? It's like, it's the way it goes. Now, the issue is, though, that the pigs are difficult because on the outside, what do they look like? Split hoof.
Yeah.
So it's easy to mistake them as something that could be clean. They've got one of the signs. But if you don't know anything about pigs and you understand that they need to chew the cud as well, you realize they don't have both witnesses. So they aren't clean. It's the same with the fish. What do they need?
Fins and scales.
Exactly. So again, we have the two witnesses. So we want to make sure we've got both witnesses involved here. So now let's go back to our... So now we found out what the mark of God is anyways on us. Is the sign of the Sabbath, right? Now, beast worshippers do not observe Sabbath. That's Revelation 14:11, and we'll go to that one. Revelation 14:11. And the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest, day or night, who worship the beast and his image, and whoever receives the mark of his name. Here is the patience of the saints. Here are those who keep the commandments of Elohim and the faith of Yeshua. So we have a difference here of, but Scott mentioned earlier about the connection between the Sabbath and rest. You start running through the scriptures and look up everywhere it mentions rest. In a lot of cases, it's always connected with the Sabbath. So this again is right on the heels of chapter 13. So the whole concept here is that these people cannot buy or sell without the mark of the beast on them, either on their hand or on their foreheads. And it's in some way connected to not having any rest. So let's sort of work this thing out a little bit longer. I wanted to touch on, let me think now, what's the next direction on that? Make sense?
No sailing.
Hopefully I'm going to help confirm that in just a minute here.
Yeah.
We're going to go to Nehemiah, chapter 13.
Yeah.
Everybody on Nehemiah 13? We're going to start in 15. Everybody understands Nehemiah. He was a priest, and he was sent back to help rebuild
the temple.
The temple, right? Him and Ezra, and the prophet Haggai. Is that correct, Scott? I believe it was Haggai. Yes. Now, in verse 15 it says, in those days I saw in Judah treading wine presses on the Sabbath, and bringing in sheaves and loading donkeys with wine, grapes, figs, and all kinds of burdens, which they brought into Jerusalem on the Sabbath day. And I warned them about the day on which they were selling provisions. Men of Tyre dwelt there also, who brought in fish and all kinds of goods, and sold them on the Sabbath to the children of Judah and in Jerusalem. And I contended with the nobles of Judah and said to them, what evil thing is this that you do by which you profane the Sabbath day? Did not your fathers do thus? And did not your God bring us this disaster on us and on this city? Yet you bring added wrath on Israel by profaning the Sabbath. So it was at the gates of Jerusalem, as it began to be dark before the Sabbath, that I contended or commanded that the gates to be shut, and I charged that they must not be opened until after the Sabbath. Then I posted some of my servants at the gates so that no burdens would be brought in on the Sabbath day. Now the merchants and the sellers of all kinds of wares lodged outside Jerusalem once or twice. And I warned them and said to them, why do you spend the night around the wall? If you do so again, I will lay hands on you. Pentecostal rubdown. From that day on, they came no more on the Sabbath. And I commanded the Levites that they should cleanse themselves and that they should go and guard the gates to sanctify the Sabbath day. I find that really interesting because who was in authority at that time? Nehemiah. So he's making a ruling on this as well. He's saying, listen, buying and selling is not going to happen on the Sabbath. And what's happening is the people of the nations of Tyre, they were bringing in goods and selling them to the Israelites, Judah predominantly. And so they are causing them to stumble. So he had the gates shut on the Sabbath so this would stop. So again, we have a connection here between buying and selling on the Sabbath. We have a leader establishing the halakha that it's not to be done on the Sabbath. That would not be resting. Because I know it mentions in the Torah that you, your maidservant, your manservant are also supposed to rest. So I look at it this way, if I'm out buying something somewhere, that person just becomes my servant because they're getting it for me. So you're causing them to work. Are they going to work anyways? Probably. But do I need to influence that in a wrong way? Is that being a witness and a testimony and a light of honoring his Sabbath? No, it's not. It's not proclaiming the sovereignty of the one creator who created that day for me to abstain from all those worldly things. So now I want to look at, we've got a little example here of what happens of both buying and selling on the Sabbath. I want to also talk now about, we go back to Revelation and it says that they can't buy or sell unless they have the mark of the beast. If you look closely at this, it doesn't say they can't buy at all.
Right.
Right. So if we think about what stops us as covenant people with the mark of God on us, keeping the Sabbath, what stops us from buying and selling? The prohibition on Shabbat.
Yeah.
So we don't buy or sell. So if God's mark on us is his Sabbaths, we keep any other day as that Sabbath, we basically got a different mark on us. Because I know the circles I used to run in, and again, I don't like I'm picking on the Christians, I'm only using that because that's what I come from, so I understand it and I know it. After service, we go for lunch.
Yeah.
You go and have breakfast. Lots of ham, by the way. And you would do all of those things, right? And it's like you were actually encouraged to go out and buy and sell on that day.
Because you're free.
So if you have that mark of that Sabbath on you, you can buy or sell any day you want. But if you have God's mark on you, then in your heart you're saying, I don't want to profane his name. I don't want to be a bad witness. So I am not going to do that on his day. That shows that mark on your head and on your hand for everybody else to see. Now, then the big question here is, again in Revelation, who puts this mark on them? It's interesting because a lot of people like to think it's the adversary, it's the devil, it's Satan that puts his mark on us. Well, let's look at some scriptural evidence that shows it isn't him that puts the mark on us. Let me find my scriptures here. Sorry, I'll back up again.
Genesis 4:15.
All right. Genesis 4:15. Somebody mentioned this already, but we're going to look at it again. Genesis 4:15. Of course, this is the story of Cain and Abel. We all kind of know how that works out. 15 it says, and the Lord said to him, therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord set a mark on Cain, lest anyone finding him should kill him. So Cain obviously is not on the right end of this firstborn issue, which is what this is all about. He was supposed to be the leader. He's supposed to be the one that is following Yah, and he's not. So because of his sin, he gets marked for it. And Yah does the marking. Well, thanks. She's got better notes over there than I do. I gotta keep flipping back.
Ezekiel 9:4.
This is actually a pretty good one here. Ezekiel 9:4. And the Lord said to him, go through the midst of the city, through the midst of Jerusalem, and put a mark on the foreheads of the men who sigh and cry over all the abominations that are done within it. To the others he said, in my hearing, go after him through the city and kill. Do not let your eyes spare, nor have pity. Utterly slay old and young, men, maidens, and little children and women. Do not come near anyone on whom is the mark. And begin at my sanctuary. So they began with the elders who were before the temple. And he said to them, defile the temple and fill the courts with the slain. Go out. And they went and they killed in the city. So it was that while they were killing, I was left alone, and I fell on my face and cried out and said, ah, Lord God, will you destroy all the remnant of Israel in pouring out your fury on Jerusalem? And he said, the iniquity of the house of Israel and Judah is exceedingly great, and the land is full of bloodshed, and the city full of perversity. For they say the Lord has forsaken the land, and the Lord does not see. And as for me also, my eye will neither spare, nor will I have pity. I will recompense their deeds on their own heads. So again, we have a mark being put on these people. A mark that the angel that's going through this, causing this destruction, is not to touch them. Everybody else he's supposed to touch. There's other marks as well. We're going to take a look at some of those. have Job 10:14. If I sin, then you mark me, and I will not acquit, and will not acquit me of my iniquity. If I am wicked, woe to me. Even if I am righteous, I cannot lift up my head. I am full of disgrace. See my misery. So again, we have this concept of mark, and this is Yah doing the marking again. So we're finding that he's marking for good and for bad in some cases. Yes, Alice.
Well, if we do wrong, we know that the Lord's going to mark us, right?
Well, that seems to be the case, does it
so
not?
That's sort of what we do ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is. It is our own choice. Yeah. You know, it's our choices and it's our decisions that are, like Scott is talking about, either we're going to the Olam Haba.
Or Olam Jose.
Which one, Jose, whichever one you decide you're going to take, right? Are you going to go earthly realm or are you going to go heavenly realm?
Also, the word sin is hata, it means to miss the mark.
Yes, that's very good. Yes. Again, we have this mark idea. All right. Ezekiel 4, let me see here. Now, again, we've got this two witness idea. The one in Revelation, it's either on their hands or their foreheads, it's only in one place. Now, this whole idea of Shabbat, okay. In Revelation 14:11, we have the whole concept again that the ones that keep the Torah and the Shabbat, the testimony of Yeshua, and keep the commandments of God, right? Those are the ones that are going to be preserved in the end. In the verses in Nehemiah where we read, where we had people buying and selling on the Sabbath, and Nehemiah the leader had to shut the gates to stop these things from happening, this is the importance of Shabbat, and emerges from these scriptures. Shabbat is the preparation of the saints to rest. And this is, again, the concept of we don't count down to the Sabbath, we count up to it. Every day leads to it. Just like Scott was mentioning earlier, this, our 6,000 years to the millennial reign is a count up. We're projecting to it. We're working towards it. It's, I used to have the concept, can I have a little drink of water there, please? In my head, that the drudgery of the 6 days of work, I finally get, I finally get the Sabbath that I can rest. Whereas now I'm getting the idea in my little noggin that after we leave Sabbath, I'm ramping up for the next one. The Havdalah sort of works us into that. We need to take that light, and like we smell the incense, the fragrances, the sweet aroma of that rest with the King, we take it with us into that work week to be that light. Hang on to that light till we get to the next rest period. Next time we get to spend time with the King, which is what Sabbath is all about. Which takes us back to Genesis. It proves He is the creator of everything and we're resting with Him. It's really fascinating when you find out the first thing that Adam has to do is rest with the King. He's created. Whoop. Two more arms around here. He's created and he gets to rest right off the bat. Isn't that mercy and grace? All the way from Genesis. Thanks, Lori.
No problem.
All right. What's that?
Respecter of persons.
Yes. A Shabbat keeper is followed by his deeds. And the saints rest from their labors. For the unrepentant Sabbath rebeller, the deeds never cease. And I used to be one of those. I worked 7 days a week. And man is bad for this. We'll work ourselves to death if you'll let us. Yeah, and the Father knows it. He knows we need that day of rest. Or else we'll kill ourselves. We'll work ourselves right to death, chasing the almighty dollar.
Mm-hmm. It's the same thing with bees.
It is. Yeah, they will. We'll do the same. Alice.
Isn't it amazing when you work 7 days a week, how you elevate yourself and just praise yourself, what a hard worker you are?
It is.
Aren't I great?
It's very miraculous, too, because at the time, coming into all of this, we had a bed and breakfast, and especially this time of year, we're getting into fall, there's a lot of things to get ready. And I always found myself behind the eight ball, snow's coming, and I don't have anything ready, my wood's not in, we've got things to do, and I thought, I take this day off, I'm never going to get things I need to get done. Well, the first year, I made the commitment. Listen, it says Sabbath. It says I'm not supposed to work, I'm supposed to rest. Well, the first time I did it was the longest day I've ever endured in my life, because I'm a worker. It took forever. I said, Lori, is this day ever going to end? But as I did it, and as I was faithful, and as I stuck to it and disciplined my nefesh to know you will rest, the joy started to show up. And I think Scott mentioned it too. It's not about the feelings. The feelings, we come from a society where we want the feelings right away. You give me those nice feelings and I'll do it. That's not the way God's kingdom works. You discipline yourself, those good feelings come after. Now I can call the Shabbat a delight. Now it comes up so quickly, it's just amazing, and I can't wait for the next one. But I found out, after taking a whole day out of my work week, that fall, I had all the wood in. I had my snowblower ready to go. I had work caught up. And I thought, how does this work? I've taken a whole day out where before in 7 days I couldn't finish. Now in 6 days I've got it all done ahead of time. Again, it was miraculous. And so we see this whole idea that Yah wants us to rest. And I know even secular scientists, you look up the stats. The best day of rest for a human being is Friday night to Saturday night. And those aren't Jewish guys coming up with this. This is just secular scientists. Yep. It's a fact of our created makeup. Right from Genesis again. Back to the beginning. So these people that cease to rest, their torment is day and night. Because they're working all the time. Chasing after their god, their idol, which in a lot of cases is money. The deeds in which they put their trust become a torment, not a pleasure. Because work can be a pleasure. But if it takes over everything, it's not a pleasure anymore. It becomes a torment. However, a saint dedicates his daily deeds toward the observance of the Shabbat as a sign of a whole transformation of his spirit. So again, we're building up to that. We're working towards it. Perseverance of the saints is rest from our labors according to the commandment. Mentions that in Revelation. A fallen world, in a fallen world, the gates must be closed in order to stop the fires of commerce from burning within. That's what Scott was talking about earlier, right? In this time now, We need to shut the gates so the commerce can cease. In the time to come, those gates are going to be always open. Because like Scott said, our heart is going to be, we're going to rest. We're going to be in that rest. We don't need to worry about the commerce. We don't need to worry about all these things any longer. Unlike the Lamb's holy city, where they remain open day and night, for no one will want to do commerce on the Shabbat. It's going to be written on our hearts, finally. It's going to be the fulfillment.
I think that's why the Kabbalat Shabbat and the Havdalah are so important, because they're your rites of passage, your beginning and your end, and we need to respect those boundaries.
Yes.
Going in and going out. If you're going past those boundaries, you know, you're dancing on that outside of that mark.
Remember I told you about Sukkot is a picture of the kingdom to come. There's the temple's the only time it's open day and night, because it doesn't matter. And that goes with your question here, where you have in the New Jerusalem, it says, and there will be neither day nor night in the New Jerusalem. And when we go back to the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, it doesn't say they exist forever and ever. It says they have no manuka. They haven't entered into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's only the smoke, the memory that lasts forever and ever.
That's right.
They don't exist in that. That's what it's telling you. And it says because they don't have rest day or night, because they haven't entered where there's light all the time. The temple's open all the time, and God is the light, not...
Because it's Sabbath.
Yeah, that's what it's called.
Because it's Sabbath, right?
It's continual Sabbath.
It's His appointed time for us to meet with Him, to be in that close proximity with Him. So to take that and grab it. So again, it's really quite interesting to see this. If we start taking some of these concepts, these theologies we've learned, and lay them up back to the beginning and try to figure out what it's really trying to tell us, it takes a lot of the fear out. It takes a lot of the theology out and gets us a little bit closer to the truth of what we're all seeking and searching for.
I think what happened to us years ago when we were praying about this before, like when we first started coming into the walk the Hebrew way, we were praying, oh man, this the whole Mark of the Beast thing, it would have been a whole lot easier to be my grandmother, right? Because they wouldn't have had the technology.
Yeah.
And then we go, wait a minute, Yasses, he's not a respecter of persons, so why should my trial of the Mark be different than my grandmother's
or
my great grandmother's?
Or
Cain and Abel's.
So we have to go back to the very beginning, and if it's not in the beginning, it's not in the end. So it's not some bank chip or some microchip or something in your hand.
Will that be maybe something connected? It's possible.
Sure.
It's possible.
Hard.
Yeah. But is it something we need to worry about?
No,
it shouldn't. What do we need to be worrying about?
Keeping Sabbath.
Getting God's mark on us. Obeying His commandments.
Mm-hmm.
That's how you show you love Him. It really isn't that complicated when we really get down to it. And as it says in Deuteronomy, it's not burdensome. Also says it in John.
Mm-hmm.
In 1 John chapter 5, I believe it's verse 3, it says that if you love me, you'll keep my commandments, and my commandments are not burdensome.
And he says it loves me and doesn't keep my commandments as a liar, and the truth is not in him.
Yeah, but it's like I get a lot of people say that no, I keep the commandments, and they'll go, oh, that is such a burden. And I used to think that. I look at them and I say, you have a love problem, my friend. Because that's what it gets down to. I find them freeing. I find them a joy and a blessing. And I look around and I think, I wish I had neighbors that would keep all these commandments. Wouldn't that be, it would be heaven on earth.
Yeah.
You know your neighbors have got your back all the time. I've got some good neighbors, by the way. I just know that, wow, if we would do that as a society, what a difference it would make. So again, don't be fearful. And I find that so discouraging, because there are so many people that are mired down in fear. They'll sell things. They'll move off to some strange land because they think all this is going to hell in a handbasket.
Mostly Christians are afraid.
And it's sad, but we don't need to fear that. The Father says that there's only one thing we should fear. That's Him. Because in, I believe it's in Job, it talks about what you fear will come upon you. And I found that in my life. Mm-hmm. So you look at it this way, in Exodus 20:20, which is 20:20 vision, by the way, God says, don't fear. I've come to test you to see that my fear would be upon you. In other words, if what we fear comes upon us, Alice said it, just fear God. And He will come upon you, which is what we all want. We want to be elevated to that position.
You want to wrestle with God and lose.
Yeah.
Just like Jacob. If you lose.
Just like Jacob. You lose, you win. That's kind of like Yeshua. First to be last. And last to be first. And you want to be elevated? Be a servant. So again, this whole final tribulation and this test we're looking at in Revelation isn't something to be afraid of. Isn't something to worry about. Just make sure you've got God's mark. And it's all going to work out in the end. He's got it all covered. Let me see here. Lori brought up a good point. Good morning. God doesn't change, and He's not a respecter of persons. The way He treats everybody from the beginning is the same way He's going to treat us in the end. So again, I'm going to finish up where I started, because this is a short one today. Go back to the beginning. And that's going to give you what's prophesied in the end. This is again how the prophets, all they spoke was the word of God. That's prophecy. Because it's cyclical, it's coming around again and again and again. Find the patterns. And Scott's been really good this week in showing us some of these patterns that we didn't see before. Now we can incorporate that into what we've learned and give us more insight in what's coming. And a better understanding of what's there. Mm-hmm. All right. Any questions? Any comments?
I have a comment, but yeah. Let the questions go first. I'll show you something really neat about this passage. If you
could. Sure. That'd be great, Scott. Yeah.
Anybody have any questions first?
Yeah, I figured this was pretty self-explanatory and basic.
So in a statement, what is the mark of the beast? That was your title.
Yeah, not.
So we're talking about what the sign.
Well, what's the mark of God?
Mark of us is, but.
Well, the enemy is always a counterfeit of God's mark. So, wait, what's the enemy's Sabbath?
Sunday.
Oh.
Sunday.
Any other day than Yahshua.
You keep going with the question.
Well, that was on my other notes. I wish I would have heard that.
I'm going to show you exactly what Lord
said. Okay, let's. Okay, 1 second, everybody. What'd you say? No, Connie.
So you're saying the mark of the beast is any other day?
Any other day than Yah's mark. Yeah.
That's why he's so specific on the Sabbath.
Yes. Would you want Gloria?
When I came in, I was a little bit late, but you had said that statement, and that was what I wanted you to repeat.
Oh.
That basically what Connie inquired about, what's the statement again? You said Sunday worship is the mark of the beast?
Any other day than Yah's.
The whole concept is you want to get God's mark. Everything else is not His mark. Right? The Muslim day. What's the Muslim day?
Friday.
So if you honor Friday to worship, if you honor Sunday, so there we got Ishmael and Esau covered.
How about Christmas and Easter?
Yeah?
You're honoring God on a day that He didn't prescribe. That's mixed worship. That's the golden calf.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Another thing, too, which brought my attention was, okay, It's either you follow two witnesses or one.
Yeah, it's very true, isn't it?
Good point.
Yes.
Because one witness can lead you astray.
Yes.
Yeah.
Two witnesses can confirm.
Yeah, well, which also falls into... Let's eat it.
Yeah, let's eat it. Looks good, right?
Yeah, you know, which falls into something being kosher.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. You know?
All these are a picture.
So if we're going to stay with and determine between clean and unclean animals for food, then, you know, it's all more of a witness to us to have both signs as well to prove that we have now been kosherized.
Yes.
So, the cloven hoof is going to symbolize your walk,
exactly.
That is sure-footed,
exactly.
And that you divide the divided hoof, the clean from the unclean. Then the chew the cud, every animal that's kosher that chews the cud, it chews the word of God is what it is, and it swallows and it brings it back up and does it again. They have four stomachs, huh? Peshat, Remez, Derash. So you got to chew the word in each of those interpretations to get the full nutrition from the covenant meal.
There you go. Which is the highest form of
Gene had something.
You're good.
Hey, yeah.
Gene?
Hey,
I was going to comment. You know, Lori was saying that it was counterfeit. Mm-hmm. But really, when you think about, we don't even like to use the word antichrist.
Yes.
But the false prophet. But he's going to go into Jerusalem. He's going to counterfeit, but yet so close.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's what I'm going to show
you. The word of God, you're going to fall for
exactly.
It.
Exactly.
And that's exactly what this is.
Right.
Counterfeit.
Even the elect could be deceived. This is why we're here today, studying together, preparing ourselves, so that we can recognize these subtle deceptions. I know Peter and I were talking about this, and it's like there's so many things out there that look good. Mm-hmm. Well, even the fruit of the tree, it was good fruit. Looked good. What was the problem? I'm of the opinion that it wasn't circumcised yet.
That's a good point.
Mm-hmm. It was a good fruited tree. But guess what? God said, that one hasn't been 5 years yet, so you guys can't eat of that tree. The rest, have at.
Didn't say you couldn't lean against
that's
it,
right.
Skeleton, sit in the shade of it. Because
none
it
of that.
The tree is the Torah,
the tree
which is the knowledge of good and evil.
Exactly. But the problem
don't
with...
Don't make a covenant out of it.
And men are trees.
Idiot.
So this is another one of my examples of how to test a teacher.
Yeah.
Have they been under a mentor for at least 5 years? Because if men are like trees, and they've been studying, you don't want a novice. It mentions that in Timothy, where it talks about how to pick elders. It says they can't be a novice, because they'll get full of pride.
Yep.
Oh, why did Yeshua wait? It says, and when he began to be 30 years old, he started his ministry.
Yes.
Oh, because the same thing with the Levites and the priests. Mm-hmm. You start your education at 5 years old. Mm-hmm. The first book you learn is Leviticus.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know it never uses the name Elohim for God? It always uses the Tetragrammaton, which is showing the loving side of God.
Yes.
Because it's about the Korbanot to draw near to God.
That's right.
And a child can understand Leviticus easily. But once you become an adult, you skip it because it's too complicated. Oh, you have to come to the kingdom of God like a little child to get it.
Right.
Draw near to mommy and daddy. I love you. I trust you. See?
Yeah.
Isn't that cool?
Are you going to let...
I'm going to let Scott take this and just
finish on the end of it? Or you want it to be...
This is really neat and it's short.
Okay, did you want to include
it in this?
Okay.
So the priests and the Levites, you'll see in the Torah that they couldn't serve by themselves until they're 30 years old. So you go through the 7-year education. You start at 5. And if you're a girl, you become a daughter of the covenant or a son of the covenant at 13.
Mm-hmm.
The girls a little bit sooner. Interesting. Girls mature a little more. Girls see things more spiritual quicker than most men do. So us men need a little bit more time to get it. Because that's a natural thing built into women. Or that it's a gift of God. But anyway, so now they go through all of that, then they study, then they have to serve under another Levite or Cohen
until they're 30 years old before they're allowed to go light the incense or go up on the altar and place something. So they've gone 25 years before they even can do something all by themselves. Mm-hmm. Why? You know, when I was 18, I thought, oh, I'm moving out, I'm an adult, I know everything. Well, it's the saying, like, hire a teenager while they still know everything.
Exactly.
Because it took me till I was almost 30 years old to go back to my mom and dad and say, you know, I'm really sorry. You were right.
Yeah.
How come I didn't listen to you? Yeah. And somehow, miraculously, I didn't start teaching them until I was 30 years old. Now I know why. Mm-hmm. Because I wasn't mature enough. I didn't get it. I hadn't experienced enough life. Mm-hmm. Okay. This passage in Revelation 13, 18. Here is wisdom, the words hakmah. Let him that has binah. Oh, you're praying the Amidah for that exact thing every day. Mm-hmm. Oh, so you're going to have wisdom. You're going to understand what this is about. Count the number of the beast, for it is the number of a man, which, man, it's five. It's vav. And it vav by itself means and. Mm-hmm. Well, that's why they're working all the time. It's like, and if I do this, I'll get more, and. Mm-hmm. They never stop to do the rest and get it. And his number is, and I believe this is a problem, because if you put it into the Hebrew, 666. But really, there's no commas in the Greek. I believe it says his number is vav, and vav, and vav. It's 6 and 6 and 6. I can't prove this, but this is interesting. Okay, you put a mezuzah on your doorpost. You're commanded in Deuteronomy. And you're to write the names of God on your right hand and your forehead, and so you have the Yad Tefillin, or phylacteries is the Greek name for it, and you have the Rosh Tefillin on your head. Well, what is on, if you look on that box, what are you going to see, or even the way that they tie it on their arms, it's going to form the Hebrew letter, the Sheen, okay? All right? It's the Sheen, stands for El Shaddai, mm-hmm. His commandments. But if you don't look real close, you could have, you know, usually have like a mark like that. To make a vav, you have a vav, and a vav, and a vav. It looks pretty much like a Sheen, doesn't it? So unless you look really close, is it a Sheen? Are you under El Shaddai? Or is it Vav, Vav, Vav?
Oh.
See, and so it's counterfeit. It's really close. And I don't know if you have it here, but next time you see, it's called Monster. It's a drink with tons of caffeine in it. Look at that letter. That is a Vav, a Vav, and a Vav. I'm not just saying don't drink it. I'm not like that. I'm saying that is deception. If you don't look close, it's not a Sheen. And that's part of, uh-huh. You know, and I thought that was really interesting because all of your Jews literally have it, the Shaddai, the Sheen, on their forehead and their right hand.
Now, the understanding that we got out of that was that in the Greek original, there was no word for 666 there.
Interesting.
It was basically a symbol that looks like that in Aramaic, but in Aramaic, what you drew right there, it says in the name of Allah.
It's not Aramaic, Arabic.
Arabic.
Okay.
Arabic.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
It says in the name of Allah, but because Paul that wasn't a language that was created yet.
Yeah.
And he's going, I don't know what this is, but here's the symbol.
Yeah, John is seeing a vision, and he writes what it is he sees. Doesn't have a clue what it is.
That's
some squiggles that could be letters, could be anything.
See, I just learned something new too.
And
so,
Rico brought that up, and he says if you flip it and look at it,
it's not up.
Yeah, it says in the name of Allah.
Yeah,
yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of an interesting idea.
We don't know.
We can theorize on what it is.
But apparently in the original writing, it wasn't an actual number because that number even changed through the Greek text.
Yeah.
Originally it was 645, they thought.
Yeah. 613, some of your translations say as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so guess what that would be? It would be Vav, Aleph, Vav.
Mm-hmm.
It's still vav.
Exactly.
6, 1, 3, and some of your Greek texts say 6 and 6 and 6.
Yes.
So either way, it's saying vav, the number of man.
Right.
Yes. That's true.
So both
anyway, we're going to wrap this up.
Jean,
this gone.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, you can wrap that up.
I just wanted to say one thing, that we have to remember that the Sheen is stamped on the earth with Israel.
Right.
The valleys, and then Jerusalem is the
it's right in the valleys.
Yeah.
Well, like what Connie was saying earlier, and actually it's funny because I was working for this old friend of ours, a Christian lady, and she kind of knows a bit what we're doing. And so she kept, as I was working at her place,